Thank you for tracing money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 3:03 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is October 18th, and I thought I'd kick off with the difference between the 10-year and the 3-month because it's down to 11 basis points. Now that was rising in September, and since then it's contracted by about 60 basis points, and that's in normal circumstances that would be a lot, but this is particularly relevant because the Federal Reserve was the one who said that the 10-year minus the 3-month is the most important measure of liquidity. And well, back when they were talking about that, it was still in excess of 200 basis points. Now we're at 11. And zero is really not all that far away. It's absolutely inevitable that it's going to become inverted because when we think about the Fed funds rate, well, we're at 3.25 right now, and the odds are that it's going to rise to at least approximate the hike that everyone's anticipating in 2 weeks' time. So the 3-month is up to 3.88%, and it's going to 4. And at this trajectory, it could be there tomorrow. So that would then be an inversion of the 10-year minus the 3-month. So as if the yield curve inversion that we have already between the 10-year and the 2-year weren't enough, we're going to see an inversion of the 10-year minus the 3-month as well. These are about as reliable lead indicators of future recession as you can possibly get. And I personally, I don't feel comfortable being the harbinger of doom. But the reality is that one thing I will certainly say is that it's not the end of history, that there will be a bull market in the future. And we're going to see significant value created during this bear market because asset prices have been exceptionally high. And they're going to start coming down. We're already in the UK starting to see pension funds selling buildings. And that's just, I think, the thin end of the wedge. We've had funds investing in alternative assets in size for most of the period after the credit crisis. This bull market, if we can, I guess, think about it in terms of how do we characterize bull markets? So in the 90s, we had the tech bull market, the TMT bubble, technology, media, and telecoms. And then we had the housing bubble. Then we had a secular bull in commodities. It was never described as a bubble, but it was certainly hit hard by the collapse of the housing bubble. But there's no question that there was an awful lot of money was devoted to increasing mine supply in the period from about 2000 to 2008. Since then, there hasn't been much. But now we've had this phenomenal move where the yield curve spread has really done nothing but trend lower for most of the last 14 years. We're at negative 43 basis points right now, which is pretty similar to where it was at the beginning of 2000. And this is what I'm going to refer to from now on as the financial engineering bubble, because it was financial engineering led to the introduction of leverage to the UK pension system. And the reason they were able to do that is because it was absolutely essential. When you have interest rates that are zero, it robs savers at the expense of speculators, and pensions are supposed to be savers. They certainly reflect the trust and commitment of millions of people, and now those pensions are under significant duress. But it's not simply a UK problem. Every pension fund in the world has had the same problem. So we've had this huge movement of cash into alternative assets. And the trend has accelerated in 2020 and 2021. 2019 was the best year ever. 2021 was then an even better year for pensions because stocks, bonds, and alternative assets were massively inflated in value because of the quantity of money that was printed. Now we have inflationary pressures ramping higher. Well, I was chatting with an investor yesterday. He was saying that some of his contacts in London are reporting that there is a wave of US dollars flowing into the UK to buy properties. So that's a good part of the reason why London property hasn't been falling, despite the fact that we've had a devaluation in the currency. And on top of that, despite the fact that pension funds are now starting to liquidate some of their assets. Those prices haven't been falling because there's a just a wall of money flowing in. But this is perfectly representative of just how much excess liquidity there is in the market. And in order to quench inflationary pressures, that liquidity is going to have to be siphoned out. That continues to point towards higher interest rates. Now, obviously, the financial community are deeply concerned about the potential that the Federal Reserve is going to go too far, that asset prices are going to pull back in an exceptionally large way, and that it will be problematic to then try and reflate prices subsequently. And everybody wants the gravy train to persist, where we've had the S&P 500 bouncing from the region of the 1,000-day moving average on successive occasions. And we're kind of right there right now. So it's a natural area where if support is going to be found, then this is about where we would anticipate that happening. But support so far has been pretty tentative. Now, I saw this rather interesting chart today, and I thought it was rather interesting. So what it does is it looks at the performance of the tech sector relative to the S&P 500. And what I like about it is that we get the history in the 1950s through to the 1970s. This, of course, was the invention of the semiconductor. And then we had a profound period of underperformance in the 1970s because interest rates went through the roof, deficits went wild, and the dollar collapsed. And that lasted for a long time. Then we had the second wave of the semiconductor coupled with the internet, and we had the huge move in the 90s. Then we had the end of that bull market because it accelerated sales and pulled them forward because of Y2K, fears about Y2K. Then we had 9/11 and the sector collapsed. It then inflated a housing bubble, which was outside the technology sector. Now we've had the financial engineering bubble, and the valuation on technology is back to where it was in 2000 and in the early 1970s. I think this is certainly something that we need to pay attention to. There's the real potential that some of the companies that have done best over the last decade are going to turn into serial underperformers. It's also relevant that if we just simply take a value ETF and plot it relative to a growth ETF, it's bottomed. And now we have first step above the base characteristics. So this was a very lengthy downtrend, and the downtrend accelerated in 2020, made a new low in late 2021, and has subsequently rebounded. This was pointing towards a longer term, or at least a medium term trend of value outperforming growth. Now, in a bearish environment like we have right now, then some of the best decisions are not about what to buy, but about what not to buy. And when people have sold out at the top of the market, there's an incredible incredible tendency and a temptation to buy back and to underestimate how far something can go down. And I think this is most especially true of the large companies. Apple could fall another 15% and still only be in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And I think that is the base case. And it could easily fall more than that because it looks increasingly like a type 2 top formation, where we have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend and now subsequently a period of right-hand extension. And it wouldn't even be it wouldn't be unusual for Apple to pull back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average following one of its or the end of one of its big product cycles, because it does have a well-defined 3-year product cycle. Then let's think about Bitcoin. I've long regarded it as a liquidity barometer. What's especially interesting about Bitcoin right now is that it has lower volatility than the stock market. Now that's exceptionally unusual, and prices are locked in this exceptionally tight range where the volatility has been very mild. And for the last month, prices really haven't moved more than about $500 up or down. This isn't going to last indefinitely. And when it breaks, it's going to break out in a really emphatic fashion. But if interest rates continue to rise and alternative assets start to become problematic, then in a crisis, people sell what they can, not what they want. So it's hard to sell a building, and it's hard to sell a private business. And Intel thought that they'd be able to sell BubbleEye for $50 billion, and instead they might get $20 billion for it. Now, they're not selling quite as much of the company as they thought they'd be able to, but they need the cash. The share, just since the beginning of the year, is down from 55 to 25, so it's halved. And this is still a downtrend. This is a sizable move on the downside in here today. But it's a massive markdown for an asset that had been valued at $50 million earlier this year, now valued at $20 million. And they bought it in 2017 for $15 million. Well, $15.7 million. So they're not taking a loss on it, assuming they didn't spend any money on it since they bought it. And it doesn't look like they were able to generate any benefit from that ownership, because autonomous vehicles aren't, or at least don't appear to be, very much closer to commercialization than they were only a couple of years ago. So now let's think about Tesla. I think one thing that Tesla has is a significant liability in the CEO. Elon Musk has become progressively more vocal, and he's got his fingers in a lot of pies. So Tesla manufactures cars in the USA. It's trying to manufacture them in Germany, and its biggest production is in China. And it has, and then Elon Musk has his network of satellites that are providing telemetry for the Ukrainian military. The Chinese have told him, and they've asked him to guarantee that he's never going to put one of those satellites over China. And then, of course, you have his other businesses. So, you know, he has his rocket business. He wants to talk about supersonic travel or hypersonic travel. He wants to talk about putting chips in people's brains. And that would be a lot easier to do in China than anywhere else in the world. And then, of course, he still wants to sell cars in China. Well, he'd better toe the party line if he wants to sell cars in China. And then, of course, there is the question. If we are going towards more autonomous vehicles, will that kind of technology be prohibited for export to China? And will Tesla have to pull out? Now, forget all of that for a moment and simply look at the consistency of the trend, because we've had a sizable pullback. Now, it's perhaps more relevant to look at it on a log scale chart. We had a big breakout in 2019, and it came back to test the upper side of the base. Then it broke out again and had a range in the latter half of 2020, and broke out and had another range in the early part of 2021. And then it broke out again at the end of 2021. And that whole move going from 20 to 400 was a big move. Since then, the sequence of higher reaction lows is no longer intact, and the price is back now in the region of the lows, the lower side of the underlying range. If one had a midpoint danger line stop, it would have been triggered. The risk is obvious that the price breaks through the $200 level and then collapses. But of course, there's still a lot of enthusiasm for renewable energy. There's a huge amount of money still chasing investments in battery technology. I continue to see stories about new investments in new companies in iron air batteries. But the companies themselves that are, and I think ESS Corp is a good example of that. They have an order book in the billions, and they're only just beginning to install their batteries. So that would seem to be a good news story, but the price is going down, and we're seeing multi-100 million dollar and billion-dollar investments in new iron-to-air batteries. And when are we going to see returns from those? When are they going to start going up in price? And these are, I think, some of the more difficult things, is that there's still this huge amount of money floating around looking for attractive assets, and there's so much competition. If one had invested in these kinds of batteries 5 years ago, when the technology was coming out, and commercialized it then there might have been you might have, there might have been first mover benefits, but the first mover benefits no longer exist, and the technology is not sufficiently difficult to replicate in order to build up a competitive moat. So these companies are really struggling here. And this is against a background of higher interest rates. And I think that the underperformance of the solar sector, despite the fact that the US government has extended the subsidy until 2030, the TAN ETF came down from 90 to 65, and it's just beginning to steady here. So even the technology sectors that have got clear government support aren't doing especially well. Now, we continue to see that the 10-year yield is pushing 4%, and it was pausing in here today. It hasn't quite been able to push up through it, but there's no sign of a clear downward dynamic like we saw at the end of September, and even that only held it up for 5 days. As long as bond yields are rising, it's going to be difficult to justify bargain hunting within the stock market. Now, one thing that I think is especially interesting right now is the dollar. So the dollar index is still hovering here around 112. The Biden administration announced today that they're going to release even more oil from the Strategic Reserve. So it's down now to levels it hasn't been at since the early 1980s. And the midterm election is only 3 weeks away. So they want to ensure that oil prices don't surge into that election. And by continuing to sell out of the strategic reserve, they can do that. But what happens afterwards? Then the strategic reserve is going to basically be empty, and they're going to need much lower prices to refill it at a justifiable price. And they were talking about refilling it at $80 a barrel. Well, West Texas Intermediate is at $83 a barrel right now. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. If you're selling at 83 and buying at 80, that's really not good economics. But then there's the other question. With bond yields rising, staying high for longer, and the government running significant deficits, eventually the sustainability of that debt is going to become a pressing matter. It's not being considered right now because we're only 3 weeks away from the midterm election, but it's going to be an increasingly pressing matter the longer these rates stay higher. And there's the likelihood that they will go higher from here. And oil prices were down $2 in here today on WTI, and we're still in a supply-dominated environment. It's hard for prices to rally when the US government is selling a million barrels a day. So we're not going to see the real outlook for the oil market come to the fore until after the selling out of the strategic reserve is over. But we certainly know that natural gas prices are coming down because the forced buying in Europe has ended. So this is now a substantial breakdown. It is no longer finding support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And UK gas prices are also coming down. So storage facilities have been filled up in Europe, and this indiscriminate buying pattern is over. And I believe it's unlikely to be repeated because the number of floating regasification units in Europe is going to multiply between now and the end of March. So there's going to be a lot more storage available, and they're going to be buying right from the end of winter. So it suggests that there is room for a higher plateau, but not the spiky activity that we've seen, and these spikes are unlikely to be sustained. It suggests that Europe will get control of the energy outlook, but in the short term, prices are likely to continue to come downwards. Then copper is also under pressure, and coal prices look like they've peaked in Australia, and iron ore prices are rolling over, and copper was down as well in here today. It's rolling over following the last retest of the 1,000-day moving average. So this is also pointing towards slower growth in China, where they are still dealing with surging cases of COVID and their COVID lockdown policies. And they're certainly not going to abandon those until Xi Jinping is assured of his position as the leader for at least the next 5 years, if not for life. But the breakout above $4 has failed, and it is now distributing below the 1,000-day moving average. So if we're going to see the utopian ideals of a carbon-free global economy realized, well, copper will at least have to break out, and we'll need to see a lot more supply. And you can't do that without mining. So the green movement, as militant as they might be, will still have to come around to the idea that if you want to replace oil and gas with renewable energy, then you need to mine a lot more copper. And that means more mines, and nobody wants a new mine. And the regulations that are being imposed on the mining sector are particularly onerous. And that's before you even begin to think about the potential for surprise taxes. Well, it certainly gives some value to mines that already exist. But as long as prices are coming down, then it's going to put pressure on those companies. And Freeport-McMoRan is just right in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And Southern Copper has also pulled back sharply and is well below the 1,000-day moving average. We're certainly in a bearish environment. Recessions are inevitable, and this is a problematic outlook. Now, value is certainly outperforming growth, but that doesn't mean that value is in fact going up. And gold prices are pausing in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Gold needs the bullish catalyst of a weak dollar, and we just don't have it yet. Now, ultimately, because of the political polarization that you have in the USA and the need to placate a restive population, it's going to be exceptionally difficult to impose fiscal austerity. And when that failure becomes obvious, then the dollar will roll over. And gold at that stage will be a very clear buy, and it could surge in value. So it's certainly worth keeping an eye on because there will be a buying opportunity, but not until the dollar eventually rolls over. And I think with that, I'll leave it for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.